Good evening and welcome to another edition of Bird Calls, made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends tonight and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back. You're on.
No light. The light's not working. All right, so I'm on. All right. Well, thank you, Bill. I'm trying to figure all the equipment out here.
Well, you're on over here, so
okay,
keep going.
Great. Well, thanks for having me. And, yeah, it is feels like winter out there.
It is wintry out there. And it was just 75 yesterday.
Yeah,
what
crazy.
Are you going to do?
And as I mentioned in years past, this is the time of the year when I pull up to the station here in Shreveport. I see gobs and gobs of robins going to roost in the live oaks there at the front of LSUS.
Right.
And so I would encourage some bird watchers to, six or eight of them, to encircle that and just count birds that are coming in. I bet it would be in the tens of thousands. And I also saw some starlings mixed in. There's probably some brown-headed cowbirds, but it was majority robin, American robins, which is pretty neat to
see. And they come in right at dusk, and, they're with the sunrise and sunset.
Right. I would say 45 to 60 minutes before dark. So today I pulled up here about 5:00, and it was in full force. So I bet, because it was low light, it was cloud cover,
right.
So it was getting dark early. So I would think if you're there by 4:45, you could really get an interesting count. You wouldn't spend maybe an hour, maybe 45 minutes, but you'd be doing a clicker like people storming into a stadium to watch a really good football game.
Well, there you go. And I'm sure that's happening all over throughout the area as birds settle in for the winter.
Yeah, a lot of birds like the robin do communal roosts, and there's safety in numbers. Red-winged blackbird's another one that gets in huge numbers, great-tailed grackles. There's a lot of birds that get into these big communal roosts, and people see that. They see big, vultures all together up on a tower, and that's a communal roost as well.
Well, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. That's any call or any question regarding our avian worlds and birding. They are welcome tonight. Also, if you have photos and you'd like Cliff to identify those, please send those in during the show to wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu, and we'll get those to Cliff and hopefully use those on a future show. Cliff, we have the end of the conservation. We had a conservation tip at the end of last month's show. Can you refresh our memories on that?
Yeah, we talked about avoiding chemical runoff in our waters. We talked about how wetlands should be free of foreign objects. We talked about how, for example, we've taken lead out of shot for waterfowl hunting. And I know a lot of hunters don't like that. The lead does work a lot better than steel, but it's the lead that fell in the bottom of the wetlands that just sat there and sat there, and birds would eat that later thinking they were seeds. And other critters, not just ducks, would eat that and die of lead poisoning. So it's just a smart thing to get that out of our system. Weed killers, big problem. If you spray that at the edge or in the water, and then agricultural fertilizers, you could be putting excess amount of nutrients, which lowers your oxygen levels, which impacts the conditions for your fish, frogs, and other wildlife. And so you might be looking at your pond thinking, wow, it's just beautiful water, but chemically it could be off balance. And that's maybe why you don't have fish for, you know, taking the grandkids out fishing, or you don't hear frogs, or you might not have any birds coming to it, because looks can be deceiving. So next time you're broadcasting chemicals, whether herbicide, fertilizers, or something else, just keep them far away from your wetlands and waterways. And most importantly, read the label to make sure you're not applying too much. And we would do all that for the birds.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have phone lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And Cliff, we always do a profile species each month. And what is your profile species this month?
I was going to mention before the profile that today was a pretty good glitch on the Nacogdoches Lufkin Tower. So if people wanted to switch from the radio to stream, why don't you tell them real quick how to do that?
Well, they can go to our website at redriverradio.org, and up at the top on one of the button bars, you're going to see Listen Online Here, and you can go ahead and click on that and listen online.
Good, good. So this month we are profiling the Savannah Sparrow. This species breeds far to our north and overwinters here with us here in the south. While on its wintering grounds, the species does not sing its territorial song, so sadly, we don't have a sound clip to play for you this month. But sometimes the species will give a faint call note on the wintering grounds, which is a sharp, high-pitched chip note that sounds like tsp, 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 so not very dramatic at all. So there are over 30 species of native sparrows in the U.S., many of which occur in our listening area in one or more seasons of the year. And the Savannah sparrow is probably in the top five as having the most widespread distributions of any of these sparrows in our country. This sparrow eats seeds and insects found in a variety of grassland types, including tall and weedy, or thin and sparse, and all grasslands in between. If you walk the average pasture or field here in the listening area during the winter, this is likely the most common species of sparrow to kick up ahead of you. They're also in loose flocks, so you might kick up a dozen or more of them during a short walk through that field. They're often along those two-track roads that proceed through grassy fields. They'll kick up and perch on weeds, shrubs, fence posts, or barbed wire, often looking back to see what flushed them. This sparrow is small and brown with a heavily streaked chest, small pinkish bill, and a faint yellowish wash to the lores, L-O-R-E-S. That's the area between the bill and the eye. One early name for this bird was the sandwich sparrow, from birds collected from Sandwich Bay or Sandwich Sound, Alaska, on the breeding grounds. But soon that name was changed to Savannah sparrow in honor of Savannah, Georgia, where additional individuals were collected on the wintering grounds. So what's interesting about this bird's name is it retained that early name, Savannah sparrow. That's Savannah with an H, by the way, at the end. It got part of the breeding ground. It got it named for breeding ground. Its common name, it comes from part of its wintering grounds, Savannah, Georgia, and all the way over to here in the listening area. But the Latin name, the specific epithet, retained the Sandwich Bay occurrence on the breeding grounds. What's interesting is I kept thinking, I don't even know Sandwich Bay, and so I, of course, did a little sniffing around, and it's now called Prince William Sound.
Huh?
So that's kind of interesting, and then everybody knows the disaster that happened in March of 89, where 11 million gallons of oil were spilled from the Exxon Valdez in Prince William Sound. But so I thought that was neat, that it's part of the names come from the breeding grounds, part from the wintering grounds, and that makes up the Savannah sparrow. And to see a fantastic photo snapped by James Childress of the Savannah sparrow, complete with tiny rain droplets on the back of the bird, please go to the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
All right. And we do have one caller online. Mary, please hold on, because Cliff's got a couple of updates here for us that we want to get through. Can you tell us, Cliff, about the upcoming bird count?
Yeah, on our bird calls page that I just gave the web address for, we have posted up, and we've done this, what, Bill, maybe 3 or 4 years in a row now?
Yes.
We get with our area compilers for 10 different counts, Christmas counts in the listening area, from Louisiana to Texas and beyond. These compilers are very great in letting us know when their count is, and we put that up on our website. So if you're in this listening area, I encourage you to go look at our website to see when the dates are, and most importantly, how to contact by email the compiler, because you want to make sure that you're legit and you are assigned an area. So work with your compiler. And if you're elsewhere in the country, you can just go online and look up Christmas bird count, and that'll get you to the National Audubon's website. You'll scroll down to, quote, join the CBC, and click there, and scroll down again, and in blue letters you'll see something that says a map view of circles, and then you'll go there to find the Christmas bird count nearest you, and then you click on that circle on the map, and it will give you the compiler's contact information. And I encourage people that are, you know, really interested in birds and getting started and wanting to get better, the best way is to go out in the field with others who have been doing it longer. You will learn a lot from those more seasoned veterans. So go on a Christmas count, and you can learn a lot.
And you can find that Christmas count on our homepage as well. It's over in the right-hand column. As you look at the website, and it'll say Christmas Bird Count 2019, there's a downloadable PDF of all of those compilers in our area, the contact information, and the dates that the counts take place.
Right. So. And so they happen during the Christmas season, so the name shouldn't make you think, oh, gosh, another thing to do on December 25th. instead, they can occur any time during a three-week window of December 14th through January 5th, and it's up to the compiler to figure out what date is used, because it's a 24-hour count. So that's the clock is ticking, and it's a 24-hour period where all the birds seen and heard are tallied. This began in 1900 in New York, thanks to a worker at American Museum of Natural History, a professor named Frank Chapman, and he designed the first one. It's really grown. There are about 110 counts now in Texas. There are about 26 in Louisiana, about 20 in Mississippi, and about 30 in Arkansas, and those are the four states that we cover here in our listening area. So, yeah, look into the Christmas bird count. It's a lot of fun, and it's definitely for all ages. I've taken kids out on our count before, and it's a really fun way for kids to get hooked too. So take a kid with you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502, and we're going to get to our first caller here. She's been holding for a bit.
Okay.
And then we'll get back to the brief update on the Recovery America Wildlife Act. Mary from Keithville, you are on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Well, we've noticed that there is a pair of bluebirds that are fighting over our bluebird box that is only 20 feet from our back door.
Yeah.
Why are they already fighting over the nest at this time of year?
Well, they will roost in that cavity this time of the year. They will stack in there in twos and threes and fours and keep warm with each other's body heat. So it could be that one doesn't want to get on the bottom and get covered up by three or four other bluebirds, and so maybe they're fighting on about who drew the shortest straw.
Well, we've had bluebirds for a year, but this is the first time we've ever seen that. So
yeah.
Thank you for letting me know what that's about.
Yeah, and they'll start looking at it for breeding purposes. They get really strong towards middle of February. And you can start seeing breeding activity shortly after that. So late February and early March, it really gets kicking. But right now, I bet you they're looking at it for roost purposes. So they're looking to make sure there's not already somebody in there, like a flying squirrel or maybe a wintering snake or a wasp nest or something like that. But that's my guess, is what your bluebirds are looking at the box that way.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
And thank you, Mary. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All lines are open right now, and you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds, the avian world, and well, nature in general will come in handy. And let's go on. Recovering America's Wildlife Act. It's a bill that has just gone into effect, correct?
Yeah, we're excited to give an update on RAWA, as it's known by its acronym, as Bill called it, Recovering America's Wildlife Act. It's H.R. 3742. We mentioned it on this show last year. And we are giving an update for you today. This is the bill that would provide funding for proactive, non-regulatory fish and wildlife conservation across the country. That includes birds, of course. In a nutshell, it helped protect imperiled species before they're lost. Earlier this month, good news was made in D.C. when RAWA passed out of the Natural Resources Committee with bipartisan support. Now it heads to the Senate. This bipartisan bill has really good support in the House, but additional support would be helpful. Please find out if your U.S. rep co-sponsored H.R. 3742, and if not, ask them via phone or their website to please co-sponsor it, and ask your senator to do the same. Our birds need your support and your voice. If you need assistance finding your local representatives, no matter which state you're in, you can go to the Texas Wildlife Alliance website at www.txwildlifealliance.org. Again, that's one word, txwildlifealliance.org. Send them an email asking for their assistance, and Rachel Rommel is the Alliance's fearless leader. So congrats to that group and others for getting this bill through the House, and it keeps pushing forward and would really benefit our birds, our mammals, our insects, our herps, everything else in between. So
you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now. All lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds in our avian world are welcome. And we did have we had one person send in some photos, and we had a Facebook inquiry that was kind of interesting. This is from Ben Jordan, and he says, a mockingbird and two blue jays are at it again, as they have been for several weeks. The mockingbird chases the two blue jays rapidly and repeatedly from perch to perch after the blue jays teasing the mockingbird. Or are the two blue jays teasing the mockingbird? Have other birders noticed this behavior, and what function does it serve?
Yeah, so that was a Facebook post that then Bill sent to me, and I quickly thought about what was going on in my backyard this time of the year. And we have some American beauty berries that have been just prolific. They have that really nice purple berry. And the mockingbird loves those berries, and he and she are very protective of that berry-giving bush. And so what I suggested is that it's just coincidence that the blue jays in the ballpark, he's probably not interested in the berries, but it doesn't matter because just his mere presence sets off the mockingbird, and you'll see that mockingbird spend a lot of time flushing everything away. And the big eaters of the berries that the mockingbird's most worried about are cedar waxwings and American robins. Those are probably the top two berry eaters that really give mockingbirds fits that are trying to save that. So it's just like you save your fridge and your pantry for you and your family. You don't have that on the front porch for anybody to help themselves to your milk and your Lucky Charms. So that's what he's doing. He's saving that food for him, and or she's saving it for herself. And so the blue jay just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it looked like they were playing. It looked like the blue jay was teasing the mockingbird, but in fact, this is, you know, what I just mentioned is probably what's going on. And then tell us what the person responded.
Oh, yeah. They responded back, and they say, I think you nailed it on the head, Bill and Cliff. Well, Cliff, there's a huge holly tree in my backyard that is covered in ripe red berries. The game of tag between the birds centers in and around it. I know the mockingbird can be very aggressive and territorial, but I usually associated that behavior with courtship, nesting, and raising the young.
Yeah, so he said we nailed it, and then I immediately thought of why aren't we on a game show where that's the final question that's worth $100 million, and we answer it and we get to split it.
There you go.
You know, 50-50, right?
Who's got the 100 million out there? So give us a call now at 800-552-8502. And you are listening to Bird Calls. We have all lines open and ready for your phone calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Best to get in when the phone lines are empty. And we did have a listener send in or email us a photo. Michiko sent a couple of images and writes, this bird didn't move while I took the picture. Sitting in the sun was probably more of a priority this AM. Yesterday afternoon, it was waddling around and she noticed a forward and backward motion and head motion like a chicken. It's about 6 inches in length, feathers and fluffed, but the size was about the same when it was walking around. Short tail feathers extend about an inch and a half.
Yeah, and she sent pictures of what was clearly an immature dove. It wasn't fully feathered, so it was hard to tell. But as I recall, it was a cold day.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, it's probably a mourning dove or a Eurasian collar dove. I couldn't really tell from the pictures. But what's interesting is both of those species will nest almost year-round. I mean, there are accounts of mourning doves putting out 4 and 5 clutches a year, and to do that, they're nesting in the cold months. And so the collar dove, I think that's one of the ways that you can colonize, like that bird has done, because 20 years ago, there were hardly any. If you go 30 years ago, there weren't any in our listening area, and they have gone like a Ferrari off the start, 0 to 60 in no time, because of being able to breed many times and just pump out a lot of young. So what she had was an immature dove, probably a mourning dove or a Eurasian collar dove. I think if it was another few weeks later, I would have been able to tell. But both doves make pretty crappy nests, and it wouldn't be surprising if the wind blew and knocked the young bird out, or some critter got too close to it, and instead of being, you know, lunch for some predator, it decided to jump out. But there's really not much to do. If you find a baby dove, it's just probably the best thing is get it up off the ground if you can approach it. Get it up on the fence post or up on a limb. But off the ground, because on the ground there's so many threats. Fire ants, cats, dogs, kids, car tires, etc. So hopefully she picked it up and moved it out of harm's way.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we do have two callers online. Ryan from Alexandria, please hang on the line for a moment because Betsy from Marshall is ahead of you. Betsy, you're on with Cliff. What's your question? Hello, Betsy.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm enjoying feeding the birds in my front yard, but my neighborhood has a pretty big feral cat population, mm-hmm. and I feel like I'm feeding the cats as well.
Yeah.
And I heard that you can put mothballs around and that will keep cats away. Will that keep the birds away as well?
I don't know. I don't know if curious birds, you know, if you have seeds that are spilling off the feeder, and that's where the mothballs are, I don't know what a bird would do with that. But mammals typically don't like that smell, that naphthalene smell. So I don't know. What I would recommend is making sure your feeder is up in a very nice clearing where there's no shrubs nearby that a cat can stalk and pounce without the bird having enough time to flee. That's what I'd recommend. And then I'd say work with your neighbors, because American Bird Conservancy, that's something to Google when we hang up, is look up the American Bird Conservancy's Cats Indoors campaign. That's something they've been pushing for probably 2 decades, and it's a very very good program. It gives you ideas of how to deal with this, but this is a huge systemic issue around the country, and especially in the South, where we have mild temperatures year-round where cats can survive, versus if you're up in Duluth, Minnesota, that's pretty hard to get through the winter if you're a cat. Or North Dakota, or anywhere. I think people get the picture. But if you're down in New Orleans or South Padre Island, it is just not much winter down there, and there's a lot of birds, a lot of thicket vegetation for cats to live in. But this is a big issue, and we have at our house 2 cats that never go outside. They are indoor. They love it. They're going to live longer. They're happier that way, and we love our birds. We love our green anoles and other critters. We don't want them to be harvested by our cats, so we keep our cats indoors. And actually, we did our cats a favor, kind of unknowingly. We screened in our porch last year, or actually it was finished this calendar year. We screened on our porch, and not glassed it in, we screened it in. And we let our cats out there, so they get that fresh air, and they can look at the birds and watch butterflies, but they can't catch any of that stuff. So they're, in a sense, outside. So we kind of call it our patio slash catio. But letting your cats wander around is irresponsible, and it's a predator that doesn't belong out there. And you know it because you've seen your cat catch things that it shouldn't be. Even a well-fed cat is going to catch and kill. So cats indoors is a priority. It's one of the top two known killers of birds. That and window strikes. So you can do a lot for birds by keeping your cats inside. So Betsy, hopefully you've got some neighbors that are willing to work with you. If not, go to that ABC, American Bird Conservancy site, Cat Indoor Campaign, and see if that can provide you some help. Okay?
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Betsy.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now. All lines are open at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. And Ryan, I don't know whether we got disconnected or what, but please call back with your question and we'll get you right in. In the meantime, I've got a couple of questions for Cliff here. And one of them is, what would be a really good book for listeners who want to know about the natural history of this particular area so that they can learn what was here, what is here now, and how the evolution of this natural area evolved.
Yeah, and that, you know, that's not a bird book that we're talking about that I would recommend for this question. I would recommend a very readable book called The Land of Bears and Honey, and it was written by Joe Truitt and Dan Lay. It was published in the 80s by UT Press, and it would work for anywhere in this listening area. So even though it talks mostly about Texas, that habitat type doesn't stop at the Sabine River. It bleeds over into Louisiana, and it goes north into southeastern Oklahoma and southwestern Arkansas. So this whole listening area would benefit from people reading that book. Again, it's called The Land of Bears and Honey. It's a very readable book, and it paints a really good picture about what this countryside looked like before we settled it and while we settled it. So, yeah, that's a really good book, good question.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and all lines are open right now, so you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And as we approach the dead of winter, as it were, what should birders be looking for out there right now? I mean, what if you are a bird hunter or a photographer, what is the best possibility for you to get some good photos or just some good sightings?
Yeah, I think I'd start off with wetland, a pond, lake, something like that where there's water birds, ducks, herons, egrets, things like that. They're easy to see. They're great for photography because they're large. There's usually not limbs in the way when they're out on the water. Because the opposite would be to get in the woods and look for little tiny birds, or get out in the grasslands and look for the, for example, the profile species we talked about, the savanna sparrow. That's a toughie, and that's a real toughie for photographers. I would start off with a wetland. In the listening area here, there are lots of good places to go. Even, you know, people in Shreveport-Bossier, they're really fortunate to have just a few miles down the road, Red River National Wildlife Refuge. Mm-hmm. And that, there are trails there. There's open water. They even have some feeders going where you can see birds up close. It's a really neat spot, and it's just minutes from downtown, which I think is really cool. Where I live, there's the Ellen Trout Zoo next door to that is Ellen Trout Lake. And this time of the year, there are lots of ducks, and the numbers should go up as winter proceeds. There are cormorants, egrets, there's bald eagles. It's just a really great place to go look for large birds. So my answer is to go near a wetland, because the birds are larger and usually you can get a good look at them. Now, I wouldn't recommend the bigger reservoirs, because then all of a sudden you're like, wow, what's that tiny speck on the horizon? and yeah, that's a common loon, but you can't see it without a spotting scope. You won't get a good picture unless you've got a monstrous lens. So,
like James Childress.
Yeah, like James. he's got a 600 millimeter, and so that's a cannon, and that would do it. But just look for these smaller bodies of water that are proven, and they'll be really good. They're in Texas, we have the birding trails, now called the wildlife trails. That's a really good system of telling people where all the hot spots are across the state of Texas. So if you're in Texas or birding in Texas, you can look for online the Parks and Wildlife's wildlife trails. It'll tell you where the hot spots are for birds, so you can find those wetlands for ducks. And other states have birding trails as well. So no matter where you're going in the country, definitely want to look up the state's birding trails, because that can help you. If you got some time to look at birds, you can kind of pre-plan, just like you would on a shopping trip. You're not just going to show up in the big city and go, I wonder where I'm going to go now. You kind of plan ahead. You know what kind of shopping you're going to do when you go in that big city. Well, same thing with birding trails. You want to look ahead, kind of plan your route, and maybe pick a few stops along the way, especially if you have targets. If you want to see a certain species, a little study will get you a long way.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You'll get right in. We have a John from Indian Rock online. John, what's your question for Cliff tonight? Hello, John.
Andrew.
There we go. Yep. Go ahead, John.
Hey, I'm wondering what kind of what can I do to encourage birds that would eat wasps at my place?
That's tough. And if you're talking about those red ones with the black wings, I think those are Polistes wasps. And actually, we need Beverly Burden here with us.
Beverly, you can call in.
I think they're big spider eaters, if I recall, but I'm going to leave that to the entomologist. My brain power doesn't handle all those critters. But that's a tough one. Those wasps get in big numbers. They like to come inside in the winter, especially older houses that have cracks that they can get in. They really like old bird houses too. And the answer is, I don't think there's really much that will help you in as far as birds eating them. There are some birds in the summer months that like to eat bees, but not those wasps. The wasps are just bigger, more aggressive. But the summer tanager and the eastern kingbird, those two come to mind, but they're only here in the warmer months. And again, they really, really like bees, as in honeybees. But these wasps you're speaking of, John, I don't know what to tell you. That's a tough one. And while I got you, where is Indian Rock? I don't know that one.
It's in Upshur County, just east of Gilmer.
Okay. Wow, so that's in Texas. That's one I don't know.
Yeah, it's Indian Rock, Texas.
Okay. And okay, which side of Gilmer is it? Going which way?
It's on the east side. East side.
Okay, the opposite way of Pritchett then.
Yes.
Okay.
The other way.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. I don't know that community. I need to. Is that two words, Indian Rock?
Indian Rock, yes.
Okay.
There's a big rock there that the Indians, there's a historical marker there from 1836.
Oh, cool. That's neat. That's a neat name. I've never heard that town. It must be pretty small, huh? How many people are there?
Yeah, it's not even. It's just a little community, probably 300-400 people.
So you don't have a big giant Walmart, huh?
No, we're going to go to Gilmer.
That's a good thing.
Do you have a stoplight? That's the question.
No, we do not.
Okay, then, yeah, you're my kind of community.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, keep it that way. All right, John, thanks for the call.
Thanks for your info.
You bet. Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have all lines open right now, so you'll get right in. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502.
Yeah, that red wasp question, that is a tricky one. You know, that I thought about that with, you know, I put up nest boxes, and I think if you only put one up, they would hit it. The red wasp would get it. They'd make their nest. And I think the answer is like a buddy, Greg Grant, does. He just saturates his site with nest boxes. He puts up so many that there's homes for everybody. And so if you're trying to get bluebirds or chickadees or whatever, if you just put one up, chances are the red wasps are going to beat everybody there. So put up multiple boxes in hopes that, you know, the red wasp will be happy on that one on the left, and maybe on the right will be the chickadee, and then the other one will be the bluebird. But we've got a family property with an old cabin on it, and boy, the red wasps, they find their way in there every winter, and they're fine until you turn the heat on, and then they really get warmed up and juiced up, and then they start flying around, and you're like, oh no. But while they're cold, I hate to say it, I go in there with a vacuum cleaner and get them out that way. It actually doesn't hurt them. I vacuum them up and then go walk pretty far and let them go. I'm sure some of them end up back in there, but it doesn't kill them. But I don't swat them. That would be a lot of dead carcasses. So the vacuum cleaner is easier. But I feel for John. I don't know the solution, and it's not a bird eating the wasp that is the solution.
Maybe if you've got a wooded area near, you put up some of those boxes in the wooded areas.
Yeah, and that's right. If you've got a problem with the red wasp in the house, maybe put up a bunch of the, you know, typical bird boxes. And you know, the bigger the entrance, the better, the whole entrance for them. The wasp like that. So put up some, and maybe that's right. Maybe they'll go to those boxes because they're looking for a place to overwinter. That's what they're doing. They're trying to get into a, you know, they probably use cavity trees, hollows, topped trees, anything that's hollow that could keep them out of the elements, keep them a little warm, and definitely keep them dry. But that's probably what, you know, hollows is probably what they look for, and an old barn or an old house can sure do the trick for them.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and all lines are open right now, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. Now, in this area, you know, the birds are acclimatized to how cold it generally gets. What is the danger marker for birds in this area? How cold, if we were suddenly to get, like, minus 10 or some, you know, absurd number, which is...
Yeah.
Not common for this area.
Right. I don't, it wouldn't cause any big concern because typically those kind of events they're not 3-4 days in a row of it.
Right.
So if it's just sprinkling of, you know, one or two days here and there throughout the winter, birds can certainly get through that. It would probably be a problem. What we've seen with some of these southern birds moving north, like Carolina wren. If you lived up in the Great Lakes or the Northeast and that bird has been inching northward, I think what probably keeps it at bay are super cold winters. Most wrens are fairly lightly feathered and they don't have that big parka down coat on like a lot of other birds do. So wrens don't do very well with cold snaps. And then we've got a lot of birds that have decided that, hey, I don't need to go to Latin America to overwinter. I'm going to stay here. We get that every year. You know, black and white warbler, wide-eyed vireo, gray catbird, several of these species that are pretty hardy. And then there's a lot that are even more unusual than those I listed. But those cold snaps would probably put those birds in their place and would send them headed south where they should be. I think that tropical Perula, it's a little warbler. Any of those that linger in South Texas in the winter, they seem to disappear after cold snap. So does that mean they've died? Hopefully not. It probably, hopefully means it just pushed them on out of there. They thought, hey, this was mild for a while, but now it's not. I'm getting out of here. But overall, cold weather here is so sporadic, it's not going to be a big die-off of birds. And, you know, it's really impressive to go to some of these wetlands to the north and see water birds on ice or standing in water overnight, and then that water turns into ice, and then they've got to break through. Geese, sandhill crane, those are birds that do this, and it's pretty spectacular to see that, and they do just fine.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now. All lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And here's a question that just popped into my mind. I know growing up in Ohio, we always knew the robins would return in the spring. So when you saw a robin or a robin's nest, you knew spring was on. They were a better indicator than any weather, you know, predictor that I've ever seen. If the robins are back, even if it's a snow on the tree, you know spring's right around the corner.
That's right.
Now, you have lots of robins down here, but they don't migrate? Or is this where they have migrated to?
Yeah, this is where your Ohio birds are coming, and they're spending their winter months wandering throughout the South. And if you keep up with a berry-eating bird like a robin or a cedar waxwing, you have got to be on the move your whole winter time, because when you hit that holly tree and you strip the berries, you know, 500 birds strip the berries in an hour, it's not coming, those berries aren't coming back for another year. So they have to keep moving in search of more berries. So you'll see that. You might see big numbers of cedar waxwings, and 2 weeks later you're like, what happened? My community didn't, you know, can't find them now. Well, they've probably stripped all the berries in the area and they've moved on. They've had to move on to keep feeding their bellies.
So now the ones that are nesting over here, as you said at the beginning of the show, in the live oak trees.
Roosting, not nesting.
Roosting, okay.
Yeah, so those are wintering.
And so they may move on shortly if they strip the area of all the berries.
Well,
I'm sure they're out foraging during the daytime.
Yeah, that's right. So what's happening is this is the La Quinta bedroom are these oak trees. So they're coming in here to sleep. Another word we use in the wildlife and birds for sure for sleeping is roosting. And a communal roost is when they all get in these trees together. There's dozens of trees, by the way, in this woodlot I'm talking about at the front of LSUS. And so, yeah, these birds are probably making flights of 30, 40 miles in all directions to find these berries of various species of trees and shrubs, and then come back to this La Quinta, and they all get in the same La Quinta and spend the night together, and there's safety in numbers. And actually, there's some communication going on that where you know, skinny bird is looking over at a limb next to him, and there's a really plump robin, and he's real shiny, looks really healthy. And so the communication goes that the skinny guy is going to follow the plump guy to see where he's going, because he knows where the food is. And you have that a lot. There's a benefit to that, especially if you're skinny, to be in this communal roost, because you can find out where the fat one's going to eat. So, Yeah, so I try not to let people see my gut because I don't want them following me to my restaurants.
So, yeah, if you're hungry, follow the fat bird. So there you go. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now, so you'll get in right away. And here's another question that we have. I heard a bird names like jug blower and Indian hen, but those names don't match anything in my bird book.
Yeah.
What are these names and what are the specific birds?
Those are good ones. Those are old-timer names. We call those colloquial names, and they're probably the names that your grandpa and great-grandpa grew up learning because they didn't have bird books. And the jug blower is a great name for the great horned owl. It's if you listen to a great horned owl making its whoo, 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 it sounds like you're blowing over a jug of beverage. And you can figure out what the beverage is, but that's what where he gets the name jug blower. The other one you said is, what was the other name?
That would be the Indian hen.
Indian hen, yeah, that's another old-timer name for the pileated woodpecker. And we've talked about that name before on this show because the Indian hen, the Indian part is the drumming, the can you hear that on the microphone?
Mm-hmm.
That's the drumming, that's the Indian part. And then the hen part is the mad one right here. That part you just played, that cluck, 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 cluck. Play that again. That's the long, this part. That's the hen. Sounds like a chicken out in the woods. That's the pileated. And that's where he gets the hen part. Sounds like he's a chicken clucking out in the woods. So, yeah, they're great names. And unfortunately, our bird books don't include that. The field guides, the pocket size ones, they have to limit the amount of information. Otherwise, they wouldn't fit in your pocket, would they?
Well, that would be a problem, given all the colloquial names that you can find. Even
right.
In an area, even in a region like this.
Yeah.
Regionally, it differs from maybe Arkansas to South Louisiana.
Oh, yeah. And Louisiana's got some great ones that actually, the book by Lowry, George Lowry, The Birds of Louisiana, he includes a lot of the Cajun names with the species account. So it'll say, you know, American coot, and that's the ornithological name, but then it'll say pooldew, or it'll say dogree, or grosbeak for the night heron. So, yeah, there are some books, older books, that include it. And actually the best book is, it's got a bald eagle on the cover. I think it's edited by John Terrace, T-E-R-R-E-S. I think it's called Encyclopedia to the Birds of North America. And those accounts, buried deep within, are, it says other names or old names or something like that. And you can find really good lists of those colloquial names in that book by John Terrace.
All right.
Yeah.
And we do have two callers online. You are listening to Bird Calls, by the way, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Julie from Nacogdoches, you're online next. And Jeff from Cotton Valley, please stay with us. Julie, what's your question tonight?
Yeah, good evening. So I'm wondering, when I'm freezing cold, and even here down here in Texas when it's weather like this, how does a bird in the northern reaches, the northern climates, stay warm? Because I know they get in bird baths, and I know their feathers repel water a little bit, but when it's super, super cold up there, how do they stay warm? And then also, how come there's some birds, like a hairy woodpecker, that's way bigger in size up north than it seems to be down here in Texas?
Well, that last question, I'll answer that. There's an ecological rule called Bergman's rule, B-E-R-G-M-A-N, and that person came up with this idea that critters, not just birds, that are in more northern climates, more northern latitudes rather, are larger in size than those in the southern part, same species. We call that clinal, C-L-I-N-A-L. And you can see that really well with white-tailed deer. Those of you that have been up to the Great Lakes, you go to Wisconsin and you're like, good gosh, look at the size of the
deer.
They
look like horses.
Yeah, they look like
horses.
And then those people, come down to Louisiana and Texas, and they're like, what is that Labrador running through the woods? Oh, I'm sorry, that's your white-tailed deer. Just because it looks so little, that's Bergman's rule. So when you're larger, you can keep warm. There's also another rule called Allen's rule that is affects your appendages. And so critters in colder climates typically have shorter appendages because those, you know, long legs and things are harder to keep warm. You want to keep that warmth towards the middle of your body. So if people are interested in those, again, that's Bergman's rule and Allen's rule. Those are two that are that have to do with the hairy woodpecker. Because you're right, if you go to the Great Lakes and you see a hairy woodpecker at your feeder, your soot feeder, they look flicker-sized up there. And then you come down here to Texas and Louisiana and anywhere in the Gulf, they're a lot smaller. And so we call that clinal. And it's the same critter, it's just when you're in a northern latitude, it's where it's colder, you're going to tend to be larger in size, but you're the same critter. The other question about the freezing cold, I don't really know what you're talking about there. Is she still on the line?
Yes.
Can you elaborate on your first question, please?
Well, I just don't know how a tiny little bird doesn't just freeze up when it's 20 below.
Yeah, so...
And their legs are exposed, and
yeah,
it just seems like they just freeze up into a little snowball.
Well, they typically will fluff up. You'll notice when a bird is cold, it'll fluff up. And so that's kind of keeping that warm layer inside under the feathers and repelling the outside cool air with the edges of the feathers. So it's kind of like having their own down parka jacket on. And so that's one way they keep warm. And so their legs, what's really amazing is people see ducks, and I mentioned geese and sandhill cranes in the icy cold water. This hasn't been unraveled until fairly recently about how their circulatory system is set up in their legs, where the warmer blood coming out of the heart is going on the outside of the legs. And the cooler, and it's cooled, of course, automatically by being in the water, and that goes back up into the body, closer to the center of the legs. But that's kind of neat to look up online. You can see a diagram that I've seen several times online. That's pretty cool. That shows how that warming blood keeps those legs warm, and how they circulate through the legs, just perfectly engineered to keep warm when you're sticking those feet in the icy cold water. And they're always in the icy cold water. And so, and then think about these water birds. Another benefit they have are oil glands. Some of these birds can spread oil on their feathers from a gland on the back of their rump called the uropygial gland. And so they spread that oil just like you would on your leather boots. And they spread that oil from their gland on their feathers, and it helps to repel the water so they're not soaking up water, and the water never really touches the skin of a bird. So it's repelled by the feather that's covered in that uropygial oil, and that's one way that ducks and other birds keep dry. And if you watch a duck for a long time, you'll see him dabble his bill on his back a little bit and then brush his feathers. He's moving that oil from that oil gland from the gland to the feathers to just like you would your leather boots to keep them from getting wet when you're walking through the fields. So those are a couple of ways of birds keeping warm in the freezing cold. But and I think one neat thing is when people see that, they often say, wow, that bird looks really fat. I've never seen one so puffy. And again, it's trying to keep warm. I bet you when you snap that photo of that puffy owl, it was because it was 22 degrees outside. And he's puffed up to hold that heat in under the feathers and then keep that cold air out of the feathers. So it's just like you putting on another layer, another jacket on yourself. So, yeah, those are a couple ways that birds keep warm. And thanks for the call, Julie.
Thanks.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we've got Jeff from Cotton Valley next. Jeff, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. A couple of simple questions about longevity. What's the longest living bird in our area? And on a worldwide basis, how long can a bird live? Or what's the oldest bird?
Well,
and I'll hang up now and listen.
Gosh,
I thank you for your show.
There's a website that the USGS has, that's U.S. Geological Service has on, or survey has on bird banding. And the most interesting is an albatross that is, it's a female. Her name is Wisdom. And she was banded, 64 years ago? It was in the 60-year period, 60 years ago. And she looks as good as she did then, and she's still making baby albatrosses. So she's in her 60s still having young every few years, because I don't think albatross breed every year. I'm not an albatross expert, but they're one of the more longer-lived birds, albatrosses. For the listening area, I don't know. I mean, bald eagles can live a good while. Usually your larger birds are going to live typically they're going to live longer than your little birds. But there are hummingbirds. I know that, let's see, I'm using memory here. I don't have the website up. Broad-tailed hummingbird, I think there's a record of one that lived 13 or 14 years. Just because you're little doesn't mean you're going to die in a couple of years. So some of the hummingbirds are pretty long-lived. But look up that USGS site. Just go USGS bird banding longevity records, and you can find that. Pretty quick, Jeff. Thanks for the call.
All right. And as usual, we close out with a conservation tip with each show. What do you have for us this month?
Avoiding erosion is what we're going to talk about. So sediment is the number one pollutant of our creeks and rivers, but it shouldn't be. Much of that sediment, mostly soil, is flowing into water bodies because of human activities, a situation called erosion. To avoid eroding your soils, please take a moment to think before carrying out certain activities, especially when using heavy machinery. For instance, don't plow or harvest timber directly adjacent to a wetland, creek, or waterway. State conservation agencies recommend maintaining soil integrity by minimizing activities near wetlands in order to protect water quality. Leave a vegetation buffer of at least 50 feet near any water to avoid soil erosion. If you can leave upwards of 100 feet, that's even better. The species we profiled earlier in this episode, the Savannah Sparrow, is a ground-dwelling species that is highly affected by erosion of its grassy habitat. Its home is literally washing into the water. If you have land that continues to erode away, establish native vegetation on it immediately, because the roots will help secure the soil. If that doesn't work, add something like hay bales staked into the ground to slow down the rain's runoff, which is causing the erosion. For rural landowners, contact your local NRCS district conservationist for technical assistance regarding erosion prevention. Save your soil and other sediments. Do it for the birds.
All right. And Cliff, once again, I want to thank you for joining us and being our resident expert on birding.
And thanks for your help, Bill, working that big switchboard over there.
You betcha. You have been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We want to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help tonight from Wally Derleth, Tim Schnell, and Brian Boone. This month's bird photo on our bird page was snapped by James Childress. Audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in the next few hours, and you can listen to this program again on our website, as well as all of the other programs that we've aired in this series, at redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird that you would like us to identify, you can send it to wbeckett@lsus.edu. The next edition of Bird Calls will be on Tuesday, January 14th. This is Red River Radio. Stay tuned for Radiolab, coming up next, right here on your public radio station, your voice of the community.